Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, Episode 30, Bright Lines and Blurry.
This Week in Law is brought to you by Audible. For your free audiobook, visit audiblepodcasts.com/TWiL. And by listeners like you. Thanks so much for your contribution. We couldn't do TWiT without it.
Hi, folks. Denise Howell here, and you're tuned in for This Week in Law. Well, I hope you have your questions ready. We're live today at live.twit.tv, as we are every Friday at 11 Pacific. If you're listening after the fact to the podcast, if you have time in your Fridays, please do tune in and join us live. And if you are watching live, jump into one of our chat rooms at irc.twit.tv is the IRC chat. We also have a friend feed chat going at friendfeed.com/TWiL. It'll be the top entry there. And then if you click on the timestamp, you'll see it scrolling down in real time as we chat during the show. So we have a great special guest with us here today, Doug Lichtman, who is a professor at UCLA Law School, an intellectual property law professor. So we are very thrilled to have you, Doug. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And I'm very glad to also be joined by Ernie Svensson, one of our regulars. Ernie, great. Welcome back to the show.
Great to be here as always. I'm looking forward to it. Looks like a good group of topics on our delicious links.
Yes. And folks who do want to check in before the show and submit topics, we're always aggregating links at delicious.com/thisweekinlaw with a slash and then the current number of the show. So we're /30 this week. You can check out our links there. And if you do have submissions you'd like to see us talk about on a show, tag them for This Week in Law in Delicious and I'll see them. Also with us is Evan Brown, internetcases.com. Hi, Evan.
Good afternoon. Happy Friday to you.
Thank you to you as well. So I'm thinking between Evan and Ernie and I, we might be able to cobble up enough gray matter to actually have an intelligent or at least an intelligible conversation with Professor Lichtman. That is my goal for the show. So
I'm used to calling on you, Denise. You know, I teach Socratics. So I should be asking you questions. But all right.
I know. I promise to all the listeners and the folks in the chat room that though we do have Professor Lichtman, who is a great resource to talk about all these things we're fascinated by, there will not be a test. So
you didn't tell me about that Socratic thing before we got online here. So I would have had more reservations. So
I thought they abandoned all that back with the paper chase.
It's wonderful. When you teach in the law schools and use Socratic, it's wonderful not because of the intensity or because it's a way to, you know, put people on edge, but quite the opposite. It's a way to teach people how to talk comfortably when they're not 100% ready. And if you think what a lawyer needs to do, right, whether you're in court or whether you're negotiating a deal, or you're just sitting in your office and your phone rings, right? Most of your life is about answering questions orally, on the fly, when you don't really know all the moves yet, right? Someone calls, they have an emergency. You can't say, let me read up on that and I'm going to call you back. You've got to know how to control your voice. You've got to know how to control the substance of what you're going to communicate, know when to indicate what you don't know, but still speak with confidence. But Socratic is designed to teach that wonderful interaction, which, you know, all of my students, no matter what they end up doing with their law degree, they really need to know how to communicate on their feet. And so Socratic, you know, used to have a tone of, hey, let's make them nervous. You know, stand up, say your last name and go. That's not the way we do it anymore. But the way we do it, I think, really arms them to know that, look, you're smart. You're here for a reason. You really can answer your phone and go. You really can listen to the other side at a negotiation, figure out what's really bothering them, and talk with them about it. And so I really like the Socratic as a teaching tool in the classroom, at least, for those reasons.
Yeah, I still think I should sit on the back row, though.
And I still promise I won't call on anyone here, but there is a real charm to it.
Do you still have the phenomenon of all the people who sit in the front row are called gunners and they are constantly raising their hands and wanting to participate, or is it a little bit more dispersed in your classes?
It moves around. I find that I can draw the students in. Think of what I get to teach, right? I teach the kind of things you guys talk about every week. I teach copyright. I teach patent law. I teach internet law and legal strategy. I teach the kind of stuff that most of the people in my classes are excited to talk. And all I have to do in the first few days is convince them that there's nothing wrong with being excited to talk with me about these issues. And then typically the classroom really opens up. It's fun stuff. It's stuff they know something about. It's typically things they actually care about. They're not taking my classes because they have to. They're taking my classes because this is an area of law they care about professionally or personally. And so I don't have the gunner reactions of your two students dominate. I typically get a really healthy class discussion, which is great. It means I learn from a whole mix of students. It means they get the experience I want them to get.
I think that's a really great explanation of the Socratic method. I mean, it's funny. It does get a bad rap. And I think part of it is when it's executed poorly, and I've seen that it doesn't come off well. I mean, some teachers don't really know how to do it, not because they're too aggressive, but sometimes just because they don't know how to engage students. And obviously, you're passionate, and I think you see that as an important aspect of teaching, and I think it's great that you're able to elicit that from your students.
Right, and I found as I developed teaching styles over time, the trick to make it go, for me at least, is to ask questions that I honestly am puzzled by rather than asking questions where I'm hiding the ball. So if you ask a question where you know slam dunky the answer, it's hard to deliver it with the tone and the excitement and to be hanging on what the student's going to say back, because the answer is left. Let's move on. Whereas if you can, and again, what you guys talk about and what I teach, there are a lot of questions where it's a really good question. Reasonable minds could disagree on X. Student, what do you think? I really want to know what the student thinks. Will they move what I think? Maybe, maybe not. But it's still open enough that I'm going to be surprised a little bit by what they think to say. And then that keeps it genuine. And when it's genuine, I think it really works.
How long have you been teaching at UCLA?
UCLA, only about 2 years. I logged something like 12 at the University of Chicago before that.
Oh, okay. So in those 12 years, have you noticed some difference in the students' reactions to these copyright issues and these sorts of things about P2P file sharing and so forth?
Yeah, I mean, copyright certainly has moved in that the students are much better informed of why there are fights than they used to be. So it used to be we'd not only have to teach them about the law, we'd have to teach them about why there were such diverging views of the law. And we'd have to teach them a little bit about kind of what's at stake in the different views. As they come in now, they understand why people disagree. They understand what's at stake more or less. We still have to do a lot of heavy lifting on the law, which is fine. That's what we're supposed to be doing.
Mm-hmm. And I suppose that increase in awareness of what's at stake, you know, the copyright issues, is probably in direct proportion, you know, the way that a line has accelerated upward from 1999 and 2000, ushering in the era of Napster and all of its progeny. Wouldn't you think that probably has been one of the biggest factors to raise awareness of copyright issues in the minds of people who are, you know, in that age group right now? You think that has anything to do with it?
I think so too. I think personal experience with copyright law is a much more meaningful phrase than it used to be. Copyright law used to largely govern the interactions of companies and large scale this is and that's. But as we all well know, right now, copyright law is a lot about what all of us do every day. And once you make that move, that's the move the students are also feeling and living through. So when we talk to them about the first sale doctrine, now it's about, you know, it's about their casebooks that they might want to resell. It's about their digital downloads, and they're just not sure if first sale even applies. Right? It all becomes personal now, at least when they start. And I guess one of the things I try to do real hard in my classes is help them understand that the law is a lot more than that. That we're not just writing rules about these personal transactions. We're trying to do things that are more systemic, more about getting competition in big markets, about long-term incentives. I try to shake them away from their own narrow view. So, for example, think of TiVo. Students, when you talk to them about fair use and time shifting, they have experience with TiVo and DVRs. They like them, and they want to immediately tell me that this stuff is clearly fair use and, of course, and slam dunky. And I push them and walk them through all the logic of fair use, and at least I hope plant the seed that maybe that's the wrong way to think about it. That I get why you and I and everybody likes TiVo. I've got one. A lot of us have them. But as a matter of law, that probably should not be fair use. There probably isn't a good story as to why TiVo should get to reposition content in the way they do without permission, without paying, without anything, given that it really does compete with other services that the copyright holders would themselves offer. You know, but for TiVo, we'd see a lot more activity at Amazon Unbox, a lot more activity at Hulu and other things. And you know, as we sit here today, if we run through fair use analysis and you ask, you know, do I need TiVo to be doing this? Is there something special about not letting the copyright holders control it, but instead having TiVo? I think the answer is no. Right? Whereas do parody. For parody, I get why Madonna isn't given the right to stop Weird Al Yankovic from making fun of her. Right? If we gave her that right, it would ruin Weird Al Yankovic's work. I get that. But for what
right, and there would be a lot of issues other than just copyright in there, First Amendment issues and all that other stuff as
absolutely.
Well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the reason the First Amendment cares and the reason the copyright system wants to accommodate is the only way to get really good social criticism and parody is to separate the target from the author. But again, you go back to the TiVo example, and while you know, I hate to badmouth my TiVo, realistically, it's kind of odd that TiVo gets to run a business that doesn't change or add content, that does something that the content industry clearly would be doing today, and that really does impact the value of the work they've created. You know, the market for reruns is dead. Go ahead.
Wait a second. I mean, so you say clearly that the content provider would be providing that service. I'm not so sure that that's really true. I mean, they've had the chance to time shift. Their business model was selling advertising, in increments, in interstitials. So you have to wait and watch the advertising. And it seems like now, because of TiVo and because of these other, these technologies that have emerged and that people are using, that what is happening is now the advertising is moving more toward either product placement or having a crawl underneath the screen. But I mean, so I guess that's my first question. My other question has to do with what's the purpose for giving people protected rights, whether it's patent or copyright? Isn't it to promote the useful arts and sciences and to create something that helps the culture, helps civilization? And if the content providers aren't going to promote time shifting and allow these things to happen, which are socially efficient, I mean, I don't want to wait and watch the news and wait through the commercial. You know, I need to get through this stuff quickly. I got a lot of stuff to do.
Yeah, but time shifting is an inalienable right, huh?
Well, I don't know if it's an inalienable right. I'm just putting. You know, since we're going to ask questions and put things and juxtapose things, I'm wondering if, you know, what is the purpose of giving people these monopolistic rights for limited periods of time, very limited in patent, copyright, you know, this feature creep in there. But, you know, there is a limit to these rights, and there is a recognition that the reason that they're limited is because they have a monopolistic characteristic. So they say, okay, great, you had to create this. That was hard. For this amount of time, you get, you know, to control everything, but not forever. You know, because we recognize that at some point it's useful to civilization that this be out there and people be allowed to remix it, you know, as Larry Lessig likes to use that word. And so, you know, here's time shifting. It's great. But, I mean, the content providers weren't moving to create that. The VCR, you know, the Sony Betamax case and then TiVo, you know, these are the things that are accelerating that technology, not the content providers. They have a business model and it's hard for them to get away from it.
Yeah, I don't know. Let me try some. So all good points back. Let me try to break it down into pieces and let's see what we think. So it is true if you went to the 1980s that there wasn't an active way to easily time shift but for the VCR as it then existed. But I don't know if that's because the content industry wasn't going to move those ways itself or because the technology wasn't there yet. So we had new technology and new capabilities rolling out, which is, you know, was the videotape recorder, became the video cassette recorder, became TiVo, and on and on. And the question, you know, one question we have to armchair as we think about the law is we have to ask, you know, do we think that this is the kind of thing that maybe not immediately, but, you know, at a reasonable time in the right patterns, the content industry also would go for? And I think the answer is yes. which is to say, I don't think we would be sitting here. Let's say we make the rules that say, look, TiVo must ask and must pay. It's not fair use. They have to ask. It's not like I think the end result would be then we turn all that stuff off and go back to appointment television. We have technology now that makes appointment television look inefficient. I agree. Stupid. Very bad to tell me that if I want to watch Battlestar Galactica, I've got to be home on Friday nights. Not my life. Not what I want. Love to watch the show. It makes sense. No matter who's ultimately deciding, there's a wonderful market there where they could give me the ability to time shift. I would watch the program, maybe pay for it, maybe pay for it by watching ads. I don't have a view as between those two ways to do it. And my guess is the market would diversify. So I could pay for an Amazon Unbox and have no ads. I could get it on a Hulu and have an ad. Maybe there'd be a million other things, just like you can go buy it at Walmart today. So I don't think it's fair to say the content industry wouldn't go there. Our choice isn't, do we want time shifting or not? Our point is, how should it evolve? Should it be that the content owners have some say or have no say at all? Should it be the content owners get some of the revenue or get none of the revenue at all? Those are the real levers we're playing with. The have it or not question isn't the question in my view. And then as you go to, we've got to say, well, why do we want them to have a say? Why do we want them to get some of the value? And I think the story is a bunch of things. One, that these are incentive systems. And if you want your sci-fi, to stay with my example, to pump all the money in that it took to make Battlestar Galactica every week, they've got to have a way to make their money back. And it might be they made some of it through ads, but there weren't great revenues there. They might need to make some of it by asking me to pay 50 cents a week to watch, or by getting some of the TiVo money. So if I pay 20 bucks a month for my TiVo, they would get 30 cents of that and so on. We might want to create a system where they can pick up the value they're helping to create, because we want them to keep writing the checks and creating the show. And so there's an incentive story. Then there's also the good move you made, Ernie, which is if we don't give them that, it's not like they're going to sit and be, you know, lame dunks and just keep doing it anyway. They're playing. They're strategic too. So what are they going to do? Well, one terrible thing they're going to do is more product placement. That means I can't avoid the commercials. That means we're distorting the program from what it was supposed to be in the artistic vision of the people who did it. Right? When if Doritos show up on the Galactica, I don't want that. And so we have to sort of see all the moving parts. This is value they helped to create. I don't want them to own TiVo, but I don't want TiVo to own them either. I think there's a nice story to be told about these guys should be getting in bed together and cutting deals as between TiVo, Hulu, selling them as box sets at Walmart, showing them live with commercials, without commercials. These are all fun ways to exploit really good content. And the content creator ought to have his hands in there to some degree.
Hey, Doug. Sorry, I dropped off for a while there, but I'm back. Have been back for a while, just listening and enjoying. As long as we're on this, Doug, the inevitable question that always comes up when we're talking about whether the business models work, and if they don't work, people are going to find ways around them and break the law to do it. If we should step in and impose some kind of system where there is, I don't know if you want to call it a compulsory license or a tax. Where do you stand on that, and do you see any of those systems being a workable solution?
I've always been nervous of things like compulsory licenses, just because I'm not sure who I want to set the dollar figure and the terms of those licenses. Right? It's a pretty sweeping thing when you have the government come in and set the deal. If they make a mistake, if they make a deal that doesn't balance things intelligently, doesn't get the right incentives, doesn't allow for certain interesting other uses, we're kind of stuck. And so I've always liked the market as a more dynamic way to set up rules. That said, sometimes the compulsory license is going to be better if we think that there's too many transactions and the market can't handle it, or if we're witnessing something where the market is just clearly not working. So I'm not opposed in an absolute sense to those sorts of solutions. So for instance, you know, peer-to-peer file sharing, we might come back and say, look, it's been a bunch of years. It's a nightmare on every level of how it's played out. Let's fix it already. And maybe the fix there is to set up something that is compulsory license-like, maybe modeled after what we do for radio, make it all you can eat, make it easy, set up the money so it works. So I'm not opposed. I've just always been nervous because it depends who the government is, right? If it's the right government making great decisions, fine. But that's, the market is more flexible and allows for more failure and more different strategies. And I've always been charmed by that, you know, current economic times notwithstanding.
I think that's very well said, and it's a very good nod to the time you spent here at the University of Chicago, or here in Chicago at the University of Chicago. But all seriousness aside, I don't mean to be too tongue-in-cheek about that. Do you think that your experiences there have kind of affected and developed this notion that you have toward the importance of the market to regulate these kind of things, rather than having the government, some kind of royalty board coming down from on high saying what the market conditions should be?
Oh, sure. The University of Chicago, you know, is obviously well known as a place that believes in markets. You know, law and economics believes that ultimately markets shake out relatively efficiently, and law and economics is skeptical of too heavy-handed government intervention. Not all intervention, but we're cautious. I'm not all the way there, which is to say I like law and economics as a tool. I believe in markets. I think it's a good perspective to begin thinking about puzzles, but I also hear a lot of the problems with it. So, you know, when you lean too heavily on markets and then you look at remix, you know, the example we tossed out before, it might be that's a situation where markets are just too clunky and imperfect, and all the little details and all the little caveats of the theories about why markets work might really rear their ugly heads there and make us think, you know what, it ain't going to work so well here. Too much uncertainty, too many players. So I'm not wed to it in terms of always saying that's the right answer. I do think it's a really helpful way to begin thinking about puzzles, because it stops us from making a bunch of mistakes. Right? It stops us, I think, from saying that NBC, if it could, would turn off TiVo, Unbox, Hulu, and the like, and go back to appointment TV. Right? I think we'd pause and say, wait a minute, even in their own private interest, new channels of distribution, they get busy people like all of us and all of our listeners to actually watch their programs, that's good stuff. They're going to want that. I think Lonicon reminds us to think about the private parties in a balanced, thoughtful way, which I really like. It also then pushes us to be careful. You know, one of the words that was thrown around earlier was the word monopoly. And again, a Lonicon guy like me would just call a timeout and say, wait a minute, you know, we know to think about that in a slightly different way. So, you know, a monopoly really isn't the right word for if I owned Star Wars, because Star Wars well competes with Battlestar Galactica, which well competes with Star Trek, which well competes with a bunch of other things. And so, you know, the Lonicon reminds us that these economic concepts maybe have some good lessons to teach both ways. So an econ person say these aren't monopolies in a meaningful sense. There's wonderful close substitutes out there that make sure no one has undue market power. So I like it as a set of tools for hitting on arguments and starting good conversations about strategy. And then we shouldn't be a true believer in anything. There are times when it doesn't work. We're living through one in the bigger economic system right now, and we shouldn't be afraid to say these are really good ideas, but. And, you know, maybe to go to Denise's question, yeah, there are some copyright settings where we might need to say copyright as a private market entity is great, but here are a couple places it doesn't work so well. Let's see if we can do better.
Is one of those places where it doesn't work the area of, like, for example, documentary filmmaking, and the example that Larry Lessig constantly uses of Davis Guggenheim having a nightmare trying to clear rights for his films?
Maybe. I'm not an expert on documentary filmmaking. I've heard the example. I certainly see from talking to film students at UCLA and USC that they get a lot of grief from things that are accidentally going to show up in their movies and not be that important to the movie and not be that harmful to the copyright interest or the privacy interest at stake. And wow, what a mess. You're trying to do your movie and you're distracted by all this detail that really shouldn't matter to anyone. And so I wouldn't be surprised if there were a good example there. It's not my expertise to say for sure that there is.
Doug, I know that Stanford has its Fair Use Project and its documentary film project that's an offshoot of that. I was wondering before the show if UCLA has any outreach programs as part of the law school that work on IP issues?
We are starting literally right now an entrepreneurship clinic where we've teamed up with the business school at UCLA and the law school together to help provide legal firepower for startups. And there are a bunch of startups at UCLA off of the medical school and some of the science and engineering programs that we are reaching out to say, look, you've got good ideas, but you need help with IP issues like patents, copyrights, and trademarks. You also need basic business and tax advice. And we have started this year to arm up teams of business school students and law students to come in and help those local entities. So we're not yet out to the world. We're mainly focusing on UCLA student and faculty-run projects, but a move in that space and the kind of thing that more matches to someone like me, where I'm really interested in how can we use law to build businesses, fund innovation, and do those sorts of moves rather than going to court to litigate big issues, for example. And so we're more focused on the stuff that the corporate attorneys might do. And if we never take our clinic into a courtroom, fantastic. That's not our ambition. Our ambition is to do the stuff on the side. And then, Denise, as you know, and we have to plug, you know, I do the public-facing radio show kind of like yours, where each month we're talking about IP issues, you know, choose one issue, really try to dig in for the whole hour on it with guests and, you know, the Stanford Fair Use, the gentleman who runs that, Tony Falzone, he's the guest this month on my show, where we talk about one of his big cases and what it teaches us about the law. And that was his litigation about the Harry Potter lexicon. And so I view that as
yes,
part of what
I can't
doing,
wait to listen to that one. I haven't come to it yet in my iTunes queue, but you beat me to it. I definitely wanted to encourage people, if you enjoy our podcast, you will love Doug's at ipcolloquium.com, where he does indeed.
Hardest thing to spell. It was my big mistake. I started it last year, had all these fun names. I chose IP Colloquium, and it's so fun to like check the back end of the Google hits of how do people get to us, all the different fun spellings of colloquium and so on. But terrible
and
names.
And then Google has to correct them.
And they do a great job. Google does a great job sending us stuff.
So I love your show because you do indeed go deep on these issues and bring in some fabulous guests, and your current one with a senior VP from Warner Brothers and Anthony Falzone. I cannot wait to dig into myself. So someone in the chat room mentioned that you sound like a Jedi, Doug. So if you're looking to get more Yoda-like wisdom from Doug and his guests, please do head on over there and listen to his show. One thing we haven't discussed on our show in far too long is the good old DMCA and its safe harbors. And I wanted to talk for a bit about what just happened in the VO litigation and how that relates to the ongoing Viacom versus Google about YouTube litigation. Doug, I understand from you, you're involved in the latter. Can you describe that for us?
Sure. So one of the things I do is I try to get involved in some of the, you know, big ticket interesting cases, in part because it's really interesting, and in part because it's a really good way to try to move the law forward. You know, one of the main things I do as an academic is write articles and news editorials and things like this. But, you know, it's unclear how many more people than my mom and my colleagues will read a Harvard Law Review article on such and such. And so I try to get involved in the cases and that way get to talk directly to the court system about issues that I care about quite a bit. And so, well, one of the groups I've worked with for years now is Viacom. Great people in the legal department there, trying to think through these issues, take a balanced perspective. And one of the projects we're working on is trying to figure out what to do with YouTube, try to push them a little bit to take copyright law more seriously in how they handle their side, which is to say we can't imagine that the law allows an entity like YouTube to just take whatever comes, enjoy it, profit from it, never lift a finger to discourage infringement, to stop infringement, unless someone calls them point blank and says this URL is bad for this reason. And so it can't be that the law creates that much of a free pass when an entity like YouTube or like Veo is sitting there in a position where they could do better at low cost. Can they be perfect? No. Should they be perfect? No. That's not the point. But there are little easy things they could be doing that we think the law requires them to do. We think public policy should require them to do. And you know, unfortunately, it's in litigation instead of everyone just doing the right thing. And you know, VO guys also are having litigation. And so we've got to let courts figure out who's right.
Right. And Universal in the VO case just had their claims tossed out of court, correct?
Yeah, I believe the technical phrase is slaughtered. Yes.
Exactly. So, you know, I know you can't get into your communications with your client, but obviously that's got to be quite a blow.
It's certainly disappointing. The VO judge is a very good judge and obviously was taking this seriously and thinking it through and asking hard questions, which is wonderful. And the lawyers in the case also did a very good job. You know, Rell and Manella is the firm that was doing a lot of the heavy lifting. I know the folks there. I have only wonderful things to say about them also. So I thought there was a lot of good people working hard in that case. I obviously don't think the result came out right. That's why we have an appeal system. That's why, you know, that case will continue and there will be arguments up one level to try to think through whether it did get decided right. I think the right way to realize that it couldn't be right is just to look at what dynamic it sets up in the world. You know, I talk about the DMCA as interpreted there as an unending game of whack-a-mole, right? Basically, that decision says that the only way you can get infringing stuff down is if you, the content owner, specifically find it, point to it, and yell about it to, in this case, VO. Well, as a content owner, that just don't work, right? Because there's constantly going to be a Comedy Central clip. Person A puts it up, you whack it down. Person B puts it up, you whack it down. C, D, E, F, you'll never keep up. That's not just on VO. It's going up on VO and on Metacafe and on YouTube and on BitTorrent and here and there. You're playing whack-a-mole with one pathetic hammer, a whole bunch of moles, and being slow loses the game. Which is to say, you know, if it's up on YouTube for 3-4 hours, if we think this matters, and I think it does, if we think it matters, that's a big chunk of time. And who's going to be able to move faster than that? So I don't think the whack-a-mole interpretation of DMCA works. I don't think that's what it says. I think the DMCA says that if you're YouTube and you're told about a specific video, you have to take it down. But I think the DMCA also leaves intact a bunch of the other intuitions we've always had in copyright law about how people with the ability to reasonably detect and stop infringement need to do so. And, you know, this decision read that all really narrowly to non-existently, which is to say, I don't know after reading that opinion what the judge would require VO to do beyond responding to notice and takedown. And my view is that that's just too little. And again, I'm not an extremist on this, and I don't think Viacom is either, and we should flag that because it's a sensitive, important issue. Me, Viacom, I don't think any of us want to say YouTube should be closed down or YouTube, for every time they goof up, should have to pay. I don't think that's the story. We understand, I understand, that YouTube can't perfectly detect infringement. And even a good faith effort on their part will sometimes let things slip through. That's fine. That's life. We get it. Copyright law wouldn't punish that even aside from the DMCA. What we're fighting about, what the VO case is about, what the YouTube case is about, what we're fighting about is the low-hanging fruit. There's stuff that they totally know, that they totally could stop, that was probably even part of their business plan from the get-go. And that's the stuff that the law does and should say, come on already. You can't build your business on that.
Does it use... Go
sorry.
Ahead.
Oh, everybody,
we're all jumping
in
on you.
I provoked. Sorry.
Ernie, fire away.
Well, I was going to say, is it fair to say that the reason why this whack-a-mole situation has arisen with applying the DMCA is that when the DMCA was originally enacted, this notion of content being, popping up in this way wasn't really envisioned. I mean, I think we were thinking in terms of the slow-moving website world and not the fast-moving RSS, weblog, Twitter world. Is that fair? I mean, I don't remember the background. I remember that it was passed. I don't remember exactly the year it was passed, but it seems like it was 98. Okay, that was way before I remembered. And the web was entirely different then. So I don't think somebody who drafted a piece of legislation like the DMCA could have envisioned, or I don't think they did envision, this world that we live in, where things come up so quickly and they're put up by individual users on their own websites and so forth. I mean, that just, you know, 98, that was like 100 years ago as far as the internet's concerned. Yeah. So, I mean, does that change? I mean, they passed that law in a different time frame. So does that, I mean, isn't that the reason why we have this whack-a-mole situation, is that it didn't really contemplate this situation?
Well, I just want to say yes and no. The law always has to be written so that it can hang in there as the world changes, because we don't have time to constantly rewrite the law to fix everything. Yeah, the tax code is always 5 steps behind. Copyright law is always, right, the main act was written in, what, 76?
law is always written knowing that we're writing law now for changed circumstances in the future. And I've always been largely impressed that Congress typically leaves the flexibility necessary to deal with changed times. So yes, I don't think in 98 people foresaw Twitter. If they did, they should have invested, or I guess not. Twitter doesn't make any money yet. But I get that, that when they were writing it, they didn't quite know. At the same token, I think if you read what they wrote, they were anticipating user-generated content. They were anticipating bulletin boards, which is in the ballpark of what we're talking about, although ours are much more fancy and much quicker. It's still the same rough set of ideas. And they did try to be real careful, saying, look, there are certain functions of the bulletin board that ought to be immune because, implicitly, I think, because, one, these guys won't know any better. They can't do any more. And two, because there are other folks to go after, that if you're using the bulletin board to do these bad things, here's some other things that could be done to stop you. And I think if you read it in that kind of caveated way, so as applied to YouTube, right? YouTube tries to defend itself on the grounds that they provide storage. So to VO, VO defends itself on the grounds that it provides storage to try to use the word in the act. And gosh, I just don't think that's what the act says. It says storage, sure, but is VO a storage entity? Is that how we describe it if we were to sit down with someone who didn't know and we took their hand, sat them down and gave them the first sentence of, look, there's this thing called YouTube. Here's what it does. I doubt we describe them as a storage entity. And so I think the law was written to try to be narrow, go after problems Congress thought it understood. But you know, all that said, it is very challenging for law to keep up in rapidly changing times. And you know, if we're a little behind and fix things, that's fine too. But I'm perfectly happy with the court working inside the DMCA. I think it's got enough of a good framework that we can get to much better answers than the one we got at the beginning of the week.
It seems that one of the common motifs here, one of the common themes or one of the underlying principles is this question of scale. And I always find it interesting when talking about the DMCA and what Congress and the legislators may have, you know, foreseen in 1998 versus, you know, how things have turned out. I mean, we can't forget that at least one of, you know, many motivating factors behind the passage of the DMCA and also the legislative framework, you know, for Section 230, the Communications Decency Act, was to foster an environment where the infrastructure of the web could increase. So it's almost, you know, going to your question, Ernie, it's almost like which is the cause and which is the effect here. I mean, yeah, we may not have foreseen it back then that it was going to be as robust and there'd be so many more billions of bits of data going through the pipes every day than what there were in 1998. But isn't that what we kind of should have expected to have been fostered by setting up a framework where the intermediary is relieved of a little bit of pressure for liability occasioned by its users? And that leads me into a question that I think is you know, really pertinent to what you're thinking, Doug, on all this, because, you know, one of the things you said is, you know, we want YouTube to do the right thing and also, you know, to take care of the low-lying fruit. That seems to me to be an iteration of the question of this, how do we deal with this scale that's occasioned by, you know, the way that things are? How do we evaluate that? Where do we begin to place the responsibility on the intermediary and take it away from, or at least relieve the individual content copyright owners from being the one to have to play the game of whack-a-mole? Where from a policy standpoint should we place responsibility? Is there any way of establishing a principle to define where that line should be?
Right, great points. I just want to pick up on scale just for a second. Because I think that's a really important point you raise. A lot of the conversations we have today, the driving thing is scale. Think of even peer-to-peer file sharing. We all made mixtapes when we were in high school and pining for the right girl. And it wasn't devastating to any part of the economy. It was small scale. When I gave music to my friends, I had, what, 5 friends? Who cares? When you move to peer-to-peer online, the friendship communities become huge. Even if you just go to the friends and you add in everyone you know in high school and everyone you knew in college and everyone you're in, right, when you do the LinkedIn version of friends, even that is huge. And then when you go really peer-to-peer and say, anyone on my network is a friend, right, scale is a big part of all these conversations. And my take on scale is that, you know, many of our old cases and our old way of thinking about things like fair use had built in an implicit scale. So sure, taping for your friends is fair use, we might have said. when we meant taping your friend's footnote, we're thinking of 5 or 6 of them. And then if you just lift that sentence out of context and apply it today, when the number is so different, it doesn't work. So I think scale is huge, and I completely agree with you. That's a big point of how to think about the law and make sure we're interpreting old words right, because when the scale changes, we have to change the understanding of what was being communicated in those words.
Right. So how many feet above the ground is the low-lying fruit? Is it just, you know, is it what you could get if you were laying on your back underneath the apple tree, or should you, you know, get a small step stool or, a little step ladder?
I hear you.
Where is it?
And on that, two things. One, to concede, I think, the implicit point you're making, which is we need to be cautious here. We don't want to make it such an ambiguous standard or an uncertain rule that everyone is paralyzed with fear or litigation. And so one thing we could say that we might like about the DMCA is, to the extent it does create bright line rules are awesome, right? In that they let people know for sure where they stand and what they can do. And, you know, bright line rules mean we're going to get some cases wrong. That's what it means. To say it's a bright line rule means it's sometimes going to overlap and get wrong a case that if we thought about all the factors and did each one case by case, we'd get different. But the reason we like bright lines is, you know, we're willing to sock up a few mistakes to have nice, clean direction for the world. And so, I don't want to read the DMCA as only a bright line rule about notice and takedown. I think that's too many mistakes, too high a cost to get the benefit of clarity. But I want to leave some of the bright line nature in there. I value that too. I think you do. I think we all should. Bright line might let people do a bunch of cool stuff. If we open up some flexibility, if we say, look, in addition to the bright lines, we are going to have a little bit of a fact-specific, what could you have reasonably done? What is the low-hanging fruit? I would put every thumb on the scale to make sure we're only sweeping in the stuff that is, you're so low that if you're on your back, you're still reaching down to grab it. Right? Mm-hmm. I'm not even looking to be ambitious here. I'm looking to say the super simple stuff you could do. So, for example, on YouTube, they've got a button next to the videos where if you see a naughty bit, an inappropriate piece of flesh, you know, a knee to some people, an elbow to others, something more exciting to the rest of us, fine, push the button. And they have an algorithm that runs in the background that if you push that button enough and enough people do and da da da, they analyze the data and they do a great job of keeping genuinely naughty bits off of YouTube, or at least behind 18 and over walls. Note that they don't have a button like that for copyright infringement. They don't even let you. If you were watching and you see a clip of Mean Girls and you say, oh, that shouldn't be there, nothing you could do. They say, no, it's the job of the copyright holder. Well, why? That's so low-hanging fruit. They already built the system. It works in settings where it's in their interest for it to work, right? They don't want naughty bits. They don't want vulgar language because net that hurts their business. They want infringing material that helps them. Well, that's the only reason why they don't have a button. And so they should. There's low-hanging fruit. I've got dozens of stories like that. And I'd even go on and say that I would be willing to find ways where, look, if you miss low-hanging fruit in good faith, i.e. you didn't think of the button, but it wasn't because of your sinister ploy to run your business evilly and so on, just you missed it, fine. We should even say we'll limit or take away damages. Right? I don't want to pile on, but I do want to say either if you knowingly or by design blew off low-hanging fruit, or once I show you the low-hanging fruit, if you don't take it, then there should be legal liability. And that might do a nice job of balancing what I hear, Evan, your perfectly correct concern that we don't want to scare off innovation with uncertain rules and massive damages and so on. For good faith people doing the right stuff, we want to encourage them to get the low-hanging fruit. If they miss, we want to encourage them again. It's not an aggressive position that I think the law should take. It's not an aggressive position I think the law does take. But it's not the zero position. It's not like YouTube must do nothing because it's the fault of our user base. I don't buy it. And even if it were, if there's easy ways for YouTube to help show some respect to the copyright industry, I want them to do that. I care about copyright law. I want to make sure that Viacom, Paramount, Universal Music gets rewarded for what they're doing so they can keep funding new things. And so
it seems like this situation is one where Google is not simply doing nothing. It's sort of a parallel to what's going on in the book search litigation and settlement. They're not taking the hard line. Perhaps they are in some of their legal papers, but as a practical matter, they're not doing nothing to deal with the copyright issues on YouTube, right? They have systems in place and filters. They may not have a button that users can flag things, but behind the scenes, they do have technology in place, and that seems to be a pivotal factor as to whether they're taking reasonable steps or not. What's your take on that? And also, how does what YouTube is doing differ from what Veo was doing in their case? What were the factual differences as to the reasonable measures?
I can answer a piece of that, and I'm sure, unfortunately, can't answer a piece of that. So the piece I can answer is, you're right that Google is more in the game today than they used to be. So you go back 2 years and ask, what were they doing with respect to YouTube? Or go back to when YouTube itself was YouTube and not yet owned by Google, and it's more and more depressing the further back you go. Whereas now Google's doing some stuff. They haven't signed on to the UGC principles, which is the agreement, the user-generated content principles that almost everybody else signed, Microsoft, Yahoo, CBS, Disney, you name it. Google is the conspicuous absentee. But they are doing some stuff. Whether doing it now and how they're doing it is enough is stuff that the case will ultimately be about. And I just want to be cautious of speaking publicly about that. And unfortunately, so too with the comparison and detail to the Veo litigation. You know, obviously, in the YouTube case, we're going to have to take positions on all that. And I have positions on that. But it's not my place to go public with that until the legal team is ready to go forward together on that. And so I just want to be cautious speaking publicly about it. I do think there are differences. I also, as I said before, think that even Veo on its facts, the reading of the law I don't like. Right? I won't sit here and tell you the judge misunderstood what Veo does or doesn't do. Not my view. His comment, the judge's view, was that the law requires almost nothing more than responding to notice and takedown. And as a legal matter, I want to say that's wrong, I hope. And that the law requires more. And then the facts that the Veo's problem and UMG's case, my views aren't so much about what the facts were on the ground there as they are about what the law says. And that's where I can say with some confidence that I think that case got it wrong.
Got it. Evan, did I cut you off there a second ago? Did you have a question?
No, I think I'm all good. I'm sure I had something, but this is such a dynamic topic. Minds are floating everywhere.
So what's the procedural status of the case? When is it going to go to trial?
YouTube, I think the public information is that we're still in discovery. I think we're in the back end of discovery, according to the public docket. And then, as you well know, as you get out of discovery, you finish up expert reports and all the rest. And then there's the opportunity, if the parties so choose, to try to get some things resolved in summary judgment, much as we saw happen in the UMG-VO fight. So wouldn't be crazy to think we finish discovery soon and see some summary judgment action on both sides and then see what's left. The only added wrinkle for the Viacom fight is there's this class action married to it, which might have its own pacing and its own special issues. It's not just the companies talking about the stuff. There's a class of a diverse group of copyright holders led by some European soccer league, and they actually make the pattern a little more complicated.
Yeah, whenever you throw in a class action, things get more complicated.
Let alone a soccer league, let's be clear.
Really?
I know you can't elaborate too much on strategies and positions in the case, but YouTube's business model obviously complicates things, and that seems to change rather rapidly and is a moving target, I'm sure, in the case as to how they monetize what's going on. And I wonder if you could comment on that generally.
In most copyright fights, people want to talk about the monetization, want to talk about is my use generating income for me or not? And while that's relevant to damages and important in some dimensions, in most cases, I don't care, which is to say you could be doing something where you make nothing, but you cause a lot of harm nonetheless. And, apples to apples, as far as I'm concerned, right? Commercialness isn't about whether you make money. It's about commercial impact, whether you cost the rightful party money that we think the law meant to let them have a shot at. And so, YouTube's monetization strategy changes. And my guess is that it's largely tied to the rest of Google's business, that YouTube drives search. Search helps. I think there's some sort of story there about how that all links together, which I'm reluctant to say more about here, but obviously Google bought YouTube for a reason. They're not just collecting random, unassorted businesses. But I'm not sure those details matter all that much to the big picture fight. Right? Again, might matter for damages a little, But there are a lot of things where someone makes no money at all or isn't making money yet where who cares? The point is the commercial impact and the likely future commercial impact. That's what we want the law to focus on.
But what about the DMCA itself? Does it focus on impact or intent?
And DMCA has moving parts in all these measures. So I think one, yeah, if you look intuitively at what the DMCA tries to swing at, it tries to swing at whether you have a practical, actionable knowledge base, which is to say, do you know what's going on? And I throw an actionable there because there's something about knowing in a way that you could do something about it. Right? We all know a lot of things that we can't do anything about. So I think there's an actionable knowledge piece that's a little bit practical. I think there's an intent piece that, you know, like we learned in Grokster, you could be running a peer-to-peer business and have all these fancy arguments that the EFF will jump up and down and tell you are strong, and you will lose by flame and fire because the Supreme Court will look at you and say, we have complicated lines to draw, but we don't draw them for bad people. And Grokster, you clearly intended to run a business to promote infringement. And so while there are hard questions about peer-to-peer, because it does some good stuff and some bad stuff, there are hard questions. We don't need to have that conversation with you. You are a bad actor. Bye-bye. We'll have the hard conversation later when, you know, maybe someone more appealing shows up. So I think that's in there too. I think there's a bad actor exception built into the DMCA view of knowledge and action and intent. Then as you were waving toward Denise, there is this language about direct financial benefit. And yeah, I think a financial benefit is this broader concept of commercial impact, right? If you run your business and take a lot of money off the table and accidentally burn it, you made no money and you still took a lot of money off the world. And I can't imagine that Congress meant to write an overly narrow definition of financial impact. And note that we have tons of cases where they took the phrase from, which takes my view of what that phrase means.
Okay, let's move on to something else that is topical and copyright related, and that is the DVD copying cases rolling along and the fact that Kaleidoscape finally lost its bid. You were following that one, Doug, I'm sure. Do you have any thoughts on it?
Yeah, not so much a copyright case in my book. I look at that really as a fight about contract. You know, we had the real DVD version, the Kaleidoscope version. But you know, they're working inside a DRM system, a system that encrypts content and authorizes only certain players to play it back. And the way they got permission to get into that game was by contract, by license. And both of those cases, you know, in the end, were going to be driven by those licenses. And so while you could imagine some fun copyright issues, in reality, that was a case of private parties sharing, you know, state secrets about encryption and one private party using them in a way that the other said, hey, that's not what I meant. I said you could use it to decrypt and play DVDs, not to store them in perpetuity in your memory. And so I don't know that long run those will be important copyright cases so much as good lessons to people when you're writing contracts to be clear, because the world changes. You know, Evan's point, don't write as if you understand the world, because you don't. Scale changes, technology changes. You got to write it with a little bit of this is what I mean so that people reading it will understand. And so I kind of look at those more in that light than I do as fun copyright cases.
Go ahead, Ernie.
Well, I was just going to say, if there hadn't been the contract issue, then I guess the next point would have been whether the DMCA prevented circumvention. And what? How do you see that play out? I mean, do you think that the DMCA should be allowed? I'm not taking a position, but the DMCA.
But it's hard not to, isn't it?
Well, I mean, I just want to, you know, I'm going to state a position to focus the discussion, but because I understand that, you know, there's a need for anti-circumvention. I think that it's clear that to me at least, that the DMCA would prohibit somebody from manufacturing something that circumvents the CSS technology. So if there hadn't been a contract, it seems like to me that the DMCA would then prohibit somebody from manufacturing a device that circumvents that technology. Or do I have that wrong?
I think I would largely agree with you, again, with a caveat, you know, not my case. And so there might be some other wrinkles that are not apparent from the public discourse. But I agree with you. The DMCA does come in and limit someone's right to break an effective encryption mechanism. And yeah, that sounds a little bit like what Kaleidoscope would have been doing had they not had a contract. And so I do think it comes in. And we should also note, and it doesn't take us to note it, yeah, almost everyone listening to us and almost everyone out there, period, hates DRM, right? Digital rights management encryption technologies are enormously unpopular. I'm so tempted to add a footnote for my program on DRM, which we called Everybody Hates DRM. And we talked to Ed Felton about why that is and a bunch of lawyers about what's going on. Everyone hates it, and we can't ignore that. So as a guy who likes copyright law and thinks the content industry is a little more reasonable than the world thinks they are, and I want to be sympathetic to their needs and so on and make sure that's in our conversations. All that said, if you have something that makes sense at a high level and is maybe even right on policy grounds and everybody hates it, sorry, walk away. And I think that's where we are with DRM.
Go ahead.
No, please.
Well, I mean, adding that's a great list that you've got there and the kind of capping it off with, you know, everybody hates DRM. But one thing that I, you know, would add to it, and it seems particularly poignant in a situation where you're talking about DVDs, is there's this question of is it right? I mean, should you prohibit circumvention of a technology used to protect a work if the use that you're trying to make of it is a fair use? I know that Tony Falzone has some thoughts about this. Heard him speak at John Marshall Law School about this.
Right. And
I think that's a
just
really
to amplify
issue.
On that, one of our chatters points out what I think is just stating your question a different way, Evan. Zeph Yar, who I think is referring to the fact that tomorrow is Talk Like a Pirate Day, so get your pirate language ready, is the paradox that it may be legal, and note I'm couching that in qualified terms, may be legal to make a backup copy of your media, but illegal to break the encryption to do it.
To just use it.
Right.
All I would say, so look, that's a big problem. So ahoy, Jeff Yar, got it. Absolutely. I only have one pirate move and that was it, I promise. We love a world where things that we want to happen still happen, even if there was DRM in the way, right? So if our view is that, say, something that's fair use, what we mean when we say it's fair use is not only copyright law won't stop it, but also you shouldn't stop it either. If that's what fair use means, and we have to fight about that, it's not clear that it is what it means. But if that is what it means, then it naturally follows that DMCA shouldn't stop those things. I'll add in just the other angle on it, I think, is it's not clear that Real, for example, was defending that line. Had they rolled out a product that was really good at making backups and then not so good at doing harmful things like distributing those backup versions on BitTorrent or facilitating other types of sharing beyond backups. Right? If they had walked forward with a product that said, look, we understand there's going to be a concern that this technology could be abused. We are rock stars. We're Real. We make the coolest like stuff ever. We want to roll out something that can be used for this really good way that ought to be fair use, maybe is fair use, that might get in the way of the technology, but that's bad too. We want to help people make backups, full stop. And we see there's issues with handing that tool out like candy. Therefore, here are the steps we're taking. Whole different conversation, I take it. That's not what they did. And so I want to make sure that we don't get babies and bathwater confused. Right? I like babies, and sometimes we have to save the whole baby and bathwater combination because that's all we can do. But in this case, we don't have to. We go back to Real and say, if you want to make something that backs up DVDs, if that's what your real ambition is, and we want to fight about that in court, great. You've got a much better story to tell. That is not the reality of your story. That's their tongue-in-cheek distraction move. Oh, we're helping people, you know, helping people make backups. Just like Grokster had the audacity to go into the Supreme Court and say, we're not really about moving music around illegally. We're about passing around copies of the Bible. Come on. Right? That wasn't what their business was about. Moreover, you don't need peer-to-peer to move the Bible around. You want the Bible? There are 1,000 static websites that have it right now. Every hotel has it right now. Every church has it right now. Using peer-to-peer to move the Bible wasn't the real exciting thing of Grokster, nor was it their real use. It was the fig leaf. And, you know, I fear, although again, not my cases, they're facts I surely don't know, I fear that Real and Kaleidoscope were putting a fig leaf on top of a more interesting business. And that's why we got into fights. So I'm really sympathetic to the pirate question, which is to say, if it really were just a technology for backups, it is something we should puzzle over as to why the DMCA would stop what fair use might allow. And if it does, we should be upset about that, maybe. I think it's a really fruitful line of conversation. I also want to say that's not the real-world business interactions that were being litigated.
But well, companies who have had backup-oriented software have been targeted, right? Remember 321 Media? And they went out of business due to their litigation. So,
I'm not deeply familiar with that one. I'm so sorry. I don't know their facts.
I forget the name of their product. It was several years ago now, but they had a strictly backup-oriented product. And probably the chat room is going to chime in and remind me what it was called. They got litigated out of existence. And I believe, again, this was a long time and my memory is not what it used to be. I believe they actually reached a substantive decision in that case and, got shot down under the DMCA. And there was vindication for this notion that, nope, you can't even back up.
Right. So, copyright law now explicitly allows some degree of personal use copies and backing up. There's case law on it. There's some statutory stuff. We might even say, look, if a court went too far away from that, then maybe they got it wrong. Again, I don't know that particular fight. I guess the only thing I want to make sure we always look for is whether there's some real beef beyond that that might be motivating the fight. So if you think, for example, of like these locker services that offer you to take your own personal media and upload it into the cloud as a way of backing it up, the backup nature of that is one conversation. But then the worry that you'll hand out that password to a million other people is a different conversation. And so again, I don't want to condemn any of these things. I just want to make sure we watch for why even a good faith content industry owner might be nervous. Backups, there's money in it, but it's not like a big motion picture studio is sitting there thinking, I'm going to sell you the DVD, I'm going to hope you lose it, and I'm going to sell it to you again. I can't believe that's the strategy. I don't think that's the game they're playing with their customers. And so I often sense that there's something else going on. And the older cases I'm just not as familiar with, but certainly in the real DVD case, if you put a mainstream DVD copying product on everybody's computer, which is what Reel would do, right? This wasn't some backwater example. This was a mainstream thing that my grandma would download. Once you do that, your ability to keep things off of BitTorrent and other sources like that would be severely compromised. And so you can understand why at a minimum you might say, hey, Reel, can you do a little better for us? Can you lock the backup so it only works with this customer's equipment? Can you track the backup copy so that we could see where it goes and intervene? Right? Is there something we could do to facilitate the thing that might be great, but stops the stuff that really is not so great? And I just don't think Reel came to that story, came to that conversation with a good heart, with good faith, took any steps in those directions. And so, then they get litigated against and they lose on a contract theory.
Doug, it's interesting because I haven't really looked at it from that standpoint before. But, listening to you make these excellent points, of course, it causes me to reflect on that whole issue of the backup tapes. And I totally agree with you that in a lot of these situations, they're because of the populist sentiment, if you will, that, we should just be able to do this. People want to overlook the fact that really, the business model for a lot of organizations was created early, and they kind of have to have just enough of a storyline that there's some good faith element or something good that they're doing, and then they kind of just brush over the fact that there are these other features that enable other things that if they were to put them front and center would be completely illegal and shot down immediately. So that I agree with that, but I want to shift and ask you a different question because the area of copyright that I find the most disturbing is when it gets used, not in the entertainment world or where people are trying to, time shift or have fun or, purely creative stuff, but rather in the realm of true valuable information. Like, for example, the law. And when there was the whole issue with Westlaw claiming that it had the right to the pinpoint sites, which caused Lexus to have to cut a deal with them. And then there were, at that time, all those DVD producers who were going to create the law and make it available at a low cost to lawyers and other people. But they couldn't use the pinpoint sites, which, of course, effectively eliminates a lot of the utility of being able to cite. that's one example. Another example, and I don't remember the name of the case, but there had been other cases like this one. But there was a Fifth Circuit case where a retired airline pilot decided that he would use his extra time in his computer server and copy the building codes for some small municipality in East Texas or somewhere and put it online, got sued for copyright infringement. I mean, this is the law. You know, the law should be free, right? I mean, if any kind of information should be free, both as in, you know, available and free as in beer, it seems to me it should be the law. And I don't know, what's your position on in restricting or applying copyright to the law and you know, municipal codes and building codes and so forth?
Yeah, that's a great – and we just were doing this in my copyright class last week, in fact, the Westlaw case and some of these other related cases. I guess I have a few reactions. One is, we want someone to make the database that is Westlaw. We want people to spend energy writing good law, you know, crafting good model statutes. These are things we value in society. So our puzzle should be, how will we get those things created? And one thing you might be saying to me, which I think I would agree with, is copyright law is not a good set of law to do that. So I love the creation of databases. Databases are enormously valuable. Indeed, databases might be more valuable than a lot of copyright eligible stuff. Compare a database about the human genome to the best romance novel you can find, and I think we all would value the database more, all else held equal. And so it's not a statement about the value of them, how excited we are to have them. We might just be saying something that copyright law is an awkward way to encourage the development of databases, model statute, and so on, because it's not tailored with the right set of trade-offs. Things that you mentioned about, I want the law to be accessible, or databases, we might have views about how long the protection should last. So it might be that copyright's a mismatch, but we have to add to that sentence something else we're going to use to get those things. Because I worry on the other side that if we don't protect databases because, you know, they're fact and not expression, or make some move like that, we won't get enough of them. And like I say, as much as I love romance novels, you know, as much as the next law professor, even with that love for romance novels, if I have to choose, bye-bye romance novels, hello databases. And so I want to make sure they're protected somewhere. And again, the question is how. To do them inside copyright is messy and imperfect for a million reasons. On top of that, then, some of these examples are just unattractive no matter how we frame them. So go to Westlaw. You know, when Westlaw tried to get legal rights to the order of the cases in the books, we might have wanted to roll our eyes, because the order only has value because it's the locked-in standard approach that courts started to use. It's not like their organization was oh so clever that as an expressive matter, it's something we want to applaud and be in awe of. They snapped them in geographic order by date. Congratulations. The reason Lexis wanted to copy that wasn't because Lexis was drooling over their organizational scheme. It was because it would become the standard, and you needed to be able to cross-cite to the standard. But just to drive the point home, had Westlaw organized the cases in an entirely different way, Lexis would have been no more and no less interested in borrowing those page numbers. Right? It wasn't how they organized that mattered. It was that they organized first. And so that should make us at least worry about giving them too strong a right, because their accomplishment wasn't related to the organization. And again, back to my original caveat, though, I don't want to take everything away from Westlaw, because they really did move the world forward. And I want future things like Westlaw built. And so we need to give them some sort of protection, whether through DRM, whether through contract, whether through copyright, whether through a database bill. We need to do something. But I hear the big point, and I'm enormously sympathetic. Copyright just applied unthinkingly strikes me as an awkward way to do it.
You know, I'll tell you, that in Louisiana, it's very interesting, because we had a very forward-thinking chief librarian of the Supreme Court of Louisiana right about the time that the DVD producers were coming out with these, I forget the names of who they were, but they were coming out with these products, and she said, okay, I'm going to nip this in the bud. And she went to the Supreme Court, a chief justice, and they worked out they passed rules to say that when lawyers were citing cases, and it were cases, you know, post a certain date, and ideally that was the date when this DVD, CD-ROM manufacturers were going to be creating their products, you would have to cite first the docket number of the case, and only then at the end you'd cite, you know, whatever book you wanted to cite. But they tried to make the pinpoint site be the paragraph and the docket number, thinking that this would allow these these CD-ROM products to be sold, and they would encourage the Louisiana lawyers to use the system. And then, of course, you know, Lexis settles and everything changes. And so the rule still exists today. Nobody's bothered to go delete it. So there are all of these lawyers who, like lemmings, you know, just marching off the cliff, are taking the time, and it's mostly, I guess, the former managing editors of law reviews, obsessing about putting the site in, which nobody reads, nobody cares about, but it's the rule, you know, and it's all because of this litigation. And I just talk about rolling your eyes. I roll my eyes constantly. I'm looking at this thinking, I'm going to have to spend an extra half an hour making these sites into a format that nobody cares about to comply with a rule that was enacted to deal with this problem back when, and it doesn't even matter anymore.
Something out of Dickens.
Oh, completely. Jarndyce versus Jarndyce.
Yes. So, Doug, how did your class react to these sorts of situations and the sort of strange results they can produce?
Yeah, I think the law students are very sympathetic toward the idea that there are other ways to reward innovation than the classic copyright patent stories or other ways than doing it through funding like NIH, NSF, DOD funding. And so the students often talk back about things like first mover advantages, about things like your ability to get related products. And so our conversation went heavily in that direction to think about, well, look, if we don't recognize a copyright, what else is there that could be the incentive system?
Do you see a parallel between any of that background and what's going on with Google now and its book search litigation?
That's a tough one. I don't see those as tightly linked. I mean, the Google book search thing has so many tough layers to it in that, you know, we're out of the legal fight in a way. The copyright issue, they punted on. And so we're mm-hmm. not going to get a good conversation on the copyright issue. And then the settlement is just terrible. The settlement is just disappointing and not on legal grounds, like we sit there and talk copyright law. But you read the settlement, you say, wow, how embarrassingly self-serving and unambitious this is. You know, here we are, we're settling the rights for a whole bunch of people who are not in the room, a whole bunch of authors who are supposedly being represented here by counsel and the court, and we are not thinking at all ambitiously about what right answers ought to look like. Right? We're making a deal that basically gives Google favored status and a couple libraries favored status, when we could make a deal that takes this resource, creates it, and opens it up to everybody so that a whole bunch of entities could use the database. And not just to do book search. Let's be clear. That's not what's exciting about this as it stands. Yeah, I want snippets of books. Fine. But I want other stuff. Right? That database has data. Think of what you could do if you could mine that data to learn from it. Not to put up snippets, but to learn from it with the so-called non-display uses. That should be open to everybody, not just Google. Or imagine.
Are you talking about statistics about use of the database?
No. That's Pam Samuelson's baby. That's not mine. This is a database that have a great snapshot of the world's knowledge. All books ever published. I mean, this is the Encyclopedia Britannica on steroids. Think of what we could do to then learn from that data to understand relationships. Imagine you're making a search engine and you need to be able to take inputs from a user and figure out what the heck they really meant to look for. If you could use that database to understand how those words show up in the world's books and then get context, I bet they're really meaning to ask about dinosaurs because of such and that. Right? It's a database of information and the sky's the limit on what we could do with it. And as the deal is structured right now, it's Google's.
Because everyone's so focused on that. That's a really interesting notion what you're talking about there, learning from that. And any time I, you know, recognize people talking about a good application of the semantic web, I always get excited these days because given that database there that you're talking about, this enormous, you know, perhaps one of the most comprehensive databases ever assembled, at least from a qualitative standpoint, you know, the stuff that's in there, everything that's been written down and published in a book in the modern age. You know, there's an amazing ability to make conclusions and make connections like you're talking about there. And perhaps at this point, maybe this is a situation where we need to be forward-looking and seeing what the technology will permit us to do. But at this point, I would suggest that the technology probably to make those connections and to do that data mining and to do that analysis and draw those conclusions isn't there. But it would be incumbent upon the custodians of this data set now to permit it to be a framework, to be a substrate in which this kind of knowledge can grow through the aid of machines and through, I always hate saying artificial intelligence, but it almost, is something that would lend itself well to artificial intelligence. I think of it more as the semantic web, the machine-aided assembly of knowledge, making these connections, drawing those conclusions, something that will, propel us, inches at a time closer to the singularity. That's a really fascinating aspect of it that I don't think I had even given much thought to, Doug. So good point.
And Evan, I swear, in your sentence, I wasn't sure which way you went on one key move. So I hear all that and say Google should have no choice but to open that up, right? We need to set up a rule where we're paying for the storage and the this and the that, but there should be no favored access just because Google infringed first. And I just want to make sure I wasn't sure as you framed it back. So it shouldn't just be incumbent on them. Google will do some of that, but it shouldn't just be Google. There's some kid at MIT right now who might have a great idea for that. I want him to have access that doesn't go through Google, because Google shouldn't be the gatekeeper here. So too Microsoft, right? Microsoft, Amazon, Yahoo. Why should it be that Google gets this sweetheart deal and has control of all that data and everybody else is kept outside or just gets it in snippet form? If we're going to go ahead and bend over backwards to cut an exception in the law using a class action process that is being distorted out the wazoo, at a minimum, let's put our ambitions on and say, you know what? Build it and open that sucker up for all these different uses. Go to the Library of Alexandria. But Google likes to pretend when they write about this publicly that Google Book Search is the world's library. It's not the world's. It's a sucky library of three sentences of the book. Most of these books you can't actually read. I want to build the Library of Alexandria. This database will be key, because the moment those rights clear and everyone agrees that we can actually do an online full-text library, you need this database to do it. Google shouldn't own all this. There's no reason why, as we cut them free, we should give them everything. Go ahead, Denise.
So to cut to the basis for that assertion, you apparently agree with the folks who contend that this is creating a monopoly and that the settlement has antitrust issues and should be altered or restructured for that reason. And yet, isn't this a parallel to what you were discussing earlier when we were talking about Chicago and law and economics, that, well, there is actually a marketplace, and this is a deal cut between private parties and others, had they the initiative that Google has shown, could cut their own deals.
Right, but it's totally not. If this were a deal between private parties, Google and the Authors Guild sitting in a room smoking cigars, fine. They're in court, in a class action hearing, negotiating the rights not just of their members, but of a whole bunch of people who never got to show up, right? They're taking all sorts of rights from authors who aren't present, who aren't represented. They're asking the court to excuse legal violations. All sorts of stuff going on here that is far removed from a quiet deal between Google and your favorite publisher. Google already had that. Right? Google had cut deals with publishers already. No angst from me or anyone, because those publishers could cut deals with other people or could sign up exclusive with Google if they want to. Mazel tov. That's the market working. Here, Google needs the court. And if you need the court,
doesn't that just indict our whole class action system, though? I mean, we have agreed.
Celebrate it, Denise. Celebrate our class action system. Our class action system puts the judge in the position to pay attention to public policy arguments about what do we need to do to watch out for these guys who can't be here. The judge's job, why are we doing a hearing on the settlement? Where the two parties have agreed. They're hugging, they're kissing, they're ready to exchange big checks of money together, and the court is still doing a hearing. Thank goodness. That's the part of the class action hearing that's working, and the judge is going to hear loud and clear from a whole bunch of people that this is bad. This is not a deal we should sign off on in view of what the public interest is.
And we should have the hope that the judge has a utilitarian bent to him or her, because that really is the point at which, this notion that you're talking about, Doug, of this you know, open the sucker up, I think is what you said. You know, that seems the point at which this utilitarian greater good point can interface with the reality of the situation. So I would agree with what we're saying on the call that, you know, let's celebrate the class action system. Let's celebrate this mechanism. But wow, you know, does it ever rely so greatly on who we get in the luck of the draw when it's assigned, you know, to the judge to hear the matter? Let's just hope and pray that it's somebody who sees this larger picture. I mean, not necessarily in this instance with Google Book Search, but as there are things akin to Google Book Search that implicate, you know, vast bodies of knowledge like this in the future.
Right. I mean, and look, we're stuck no matter where we go. You go to Congress, you're going to have the exact same issue, right? So we could say, because we're nervous about the luck of the draw in the courts, we should go. But to Congress, depends a lot on, right? It's not like every member of the Senate focuses intensely on every issue. A copyright issue of three or four people who really care about it. And now we're hoping that they are not too heavily interested by their own needs, their own campaign, this is and that's and so on, and can see the big picture right. Right? Always when it comes time to choosing the decision maker, you know, other than choosing Denise, not clear what we would do in all these settings, and we have to worry about that.
Yes, and I'm not volunteering by any means. Hey, Doug, I'm going to go ahead and take a break here and let everybody stretch while we thank our sponsor, Audible. But before I go ahead and jump into that, I wanted to ask real quick, do you know Mike Madison?
I do.
At the University of Pittsburgh Law School?
I do.
You do. So I've had a link from him in our discussion points since March of this year that is a good segue to talk about derivative works and fan fiction, which I know you just did a show on, and the Harry Potter lexicon and all that good stuff, which I'd like to talk about after the break. So hopefully we can get into Mike Madison's piece about the Vader project too, which I thought was an interesting twist on all that. But first, I would like to thank our sponsor, Audible.com. If you folks listening go to audiblepodcast.com/twill, we have a great deal for you where you get a 14-day free trial of their gold program. Basically, you pay $14.95 a month and you get an audio book every month that you can listen to. You get your first one for free, and we always like to give a recommendation. And I'd like to give, finally, a review of one I recommended last week, which I did start listening to, and that was by Poe Bronson, and it's called Nurture Shock. I'm now about midway through, and it's a great, great book for anyone who's interested in learning scientific child development data about kids, but not written in a dry way, and seeing how some of this data pans out in the schools and test scores and stuff. It's a great, great book. Very interesting to get together and chew over the little tidbits you learn from there with your fellow parents and friends. But this time around, I'd like to honor and acknowledge the fact that 9909 happened, and we have the new digitally remastered set of the original Beatles albums. So another author that we're a big fan of here on the TWiT network is Mark Kurlansky. And he has a work, gosh, he's a prolific guy. This particular book that I'm recommending is called 1968, The Year That Rocked the World. 1968 was, of course, the year that Hey Jude came out and the White Album later that year. So congratulations, Beatles. And for folks who are interested in a further trip down memory lane, go and download Mark Kurlansky's 1968. Looks like a fabulous way to acquaint yourself or reacquaint yourself with that year. And I really, really love this author. I think on TWiT they once recommended a book by him that is how I discovered him. It was called Food of a Younger Land. And he's just great at examining history and making it come alive again for us today. So do check out 1968. The IP angle of all this Beatles discussion is, I'm pretty sure, isn't it true that the Beatles have never authorized their books to be made, or their books, their music to be made available in any sort of digital format? Is that still the case, or have they reneged? Anybody know the answer to that?
Well, I don't know the answer, but I know that there was an issue in last month's Wired that that addressed that. And I know that it kind of just talked about the tangles that were involved in getting all the licensing rights and also the, you know, clearing all the rights of publicity and all that stuff. So it's in not the issue of Wired that just arrived in my mailbox yesterday, but last month. So it would probably be the August issue of it talked about that.
Right.
So I don't know the particular answer, but there's a good coverage of it there.
The chat room is agreeing with me that they think that at least somebody there thinks that we're right about that, and that you can't get the Beatles in a legally authorized digital download sort of format. Let's see. Oh, also, I wanted to thank whoever it was in the chat room that reminded me that the product we were talking about earlier from 321 was called DVD-X Copy. So there we go. Thank you, chatters. You're always so helpful. Let's get into derivative works and fan fiction and fair use. Doug, why don't you bring us up to speed on the Harry Potter litigation, if that's okay, and what's going on with that?
Sure. So that one's basically put to bed. As you might remember, the fight was over a particular unauthorized encyclopedia of Harry Potter, where the author really took a lot. It wasn't one of those cases where they just dabbled in. It was an encyclopedia of Harry Potter. And so they took basically all the major characters and plot points. They took a bunch of language directly from the Potter books. And as one of the Warner Brothers executives says, it was basically the Harry Potter series, but alphabetized. And so there was a lot of borrowing. The case was litigated, you know, when I talk about it on the show, so on my show this month, we have Jeremy Moyams, who's one of the vice presidents at Warner Brothers, who was the guy who was heavily involved in that case for Warner Brothers. And we have Tony Falzone from Stanford, who represented the folks who wanted to put out the unauthorized book. And we talk about a bunch of things. We talk about the fair use issues and fan fiction and the like. But one of the legal points we try to emphasize is that the fight, it's not such a great case in terms of thinking about Section 106.2, the right about derivative work, because here was a case where if it wasn't derivative, it was then a reproduction, which is to put differently, the copyright statute breaks down rights in these different things. Did you perform? Did you display? Did you distribute? Did you reproduce? And so on. Here, the court basically looked up and said, you know what? I don't have to figure out whether an unauthorized encyclopedia is derivative of the original work. He thought it wasn't. I think it was. Who cares? The point is, he said, they took Harry Potter. This isn't about a derivative work. This is about a verbatim copy of a character that is protected. They took Harry. They took all of his pals. They took imaginary creatures. And so it was a straightforward copying case in the same nature as if they'd photocopied the book. And then the court went on to do fair use and think through, should we let these things go? And Tony makes the case, Tony Falzone, who represented the publisher, Tony makes the case that, you know what, we should let these things go, that you're only going to see these kinds of works be made of work that already has made a lot of money. So you don't have to worry about taking money from the author. J.K. Rowling is going to do just fine. Thank you very much. He also makes the case that there is a value to having these kinds of works done by unrelated parties, just like you might want Weird Al Yankovic to make fun of Madonna and not have to ask her. Although, interestingly, he does ask permission. He didn't have to. Tony says that these sort of summary-type works would be better if you could divorce them from the author. And the fair use conversation in court and the decision and what Tony wanted to accomplish was in that realm. What I thought was most interesting, at least when we covered this over at IP Colloquium, when you talk to Jeremy Williams at Warner Brothers, and you might think he'd sit there and say, these things are terrible and it should be only us and only approved and so on. He doesn't. He takes an incredibly generous, flexible view of these sorts of works, be they fan fiction, be they compatible, complementary work. He's trying, he has this line where he says, look, if it's done by fans, for fun, we're going to bend over backwards at Warner Brothers to try to make it okay. And we have, and he has this whole pile of books that they've been totally cool with. I thought it was jarring, as I talked with him, I do mine in one-on-one interview style. And so the guest takes a position, I try to push the position. And I was in the odd position of pushing him to be less generous. It was jarring how he had gone so far and, speaking about what Warner tries to do. They don't ask whether the fan fiction is fair use under the law. They ask, is this something we should be messing with? This is our fans, after all. We want them to love the product. And you know, if by them writing fan fiction, we get some seventh grader to learn how to write better or get someone to come to our movie, or there's all these wonderful things, is it really a problem for us? And if the answer is no, if the answer can be no, my sense from Jeremy is they try to let it go, which then you know, makes it more jarring. This one they sued over. This one crossed the line out of literally dozens of books he was able to hand to me when I was in the office recording the show. Dozens of books, no problem. This one they felt took so aggressively, so many direct quotes, so much of the piece's parts without adding that much of its own, that this one J.K. Rowling felt strongly about, and Warner Brothers stood up with her and said, you know, we have the right to say no, and this is one we're not too happy with. But I thought it was exciting. It was such a different message than what people pretend the content industry says. When you listen to Jeremy, you know, in the interview on IP Colloquium, he sounds like a really cool guy, and he is a cool, he's a wonderful, nice, thoughtful, open-minded guy. And you know, the best thing we did in that show is get him out there to the public, because when you hear that, it's much easier to resist the caricatures that you see on a site like TechDirt, where they pretend that the content industry is a bunch of evil ogres, or the characters you get in Bill Patry's new book, where he pretends they're all just rotten and no good. They're not. You know, I have the joy of getting to know some of these people, and they're good people who, you know, if they had a daughter and you had a son, you'd be delighted if they were married. These are good people who are trying to find reasonable balances, which I was really glad to give Jeremy a way to share that with the public.
Yeah, I agree that, you know, I'm all for people in that power position taking reasonable positions as they look at what could be potential infringement and make strategic decisions about what they're going to pursue and what they're not going to pursue. But I guess my problem is a step back from that. And that's the fact that if they decide to pursue something that is much more clearly an instance of fair use, then we still are in a world that doesn't have bright line rules and, you know, up to the whims of the jury or the court or what have you, as each bit of litigation is resolved. So, you know, I guess I'm happy to hear that people are thinking practically about that and making rational decisions. But at the same time, I wish that we were in a situation where the folks who are out there so passionately building on the things that they love, such as, you know, the whole craze around the Twilight movie. I was surprised recently in surfing around iTunes that there are albums that have been created. Now, again, I don't see an infringement issue here because they're not using any of the actual material from the films or the books, but there are original works of music that have been inspired completely by those books and that movie that are the suggested score for some of the upcoming films. That someone, you know, has put out there and says, hey, here's how I'd like it to sound. So I think that's an example of where, you know, you simply have the notion of the work in mind and have built something that I hope would be considered fair use. But there are certainly grayer areas when you get into works that use the characters themselves and some of the plots that have come before and built on them. And I wonder how you feel about the state of the law on that right now and whether you're comfortable with it or not.
I think you're going back to a good point that Evan pushed earlier also, which is, you know, when we did the DMCA part of our conversation, we talked a little about bright line rules and the charm of a bright line rule to letting people go out and do stuff and not worry. And wow, if there's some place in copyright law that we need some more bright line rules, it's fair use. A lot of people aren't doing perfectly legitimate things because they're afraid. And they're not the kind of people who can go hire a lawyer and litigate it out the way RDR Books did in the Potter case. It's people like you and me who just want to do kind of normal stuff in a low-key way with a couple thousand listeners and so on. And so I'd love to see more bright line rules. I almost wish that the advocacy arms like Standards Fair Use Project, like the EFF, would devote more of their resources to that puzzle. Let's lay out, there must be ways to lay out some examples we can all be calm with and think, you know what, that is fair use. And let's start to get a little bit more of a public consensus where we wave some things in and wave some things out. That would be enormously helpful for the real world. And then ultimately we need to do it by statute maybe and add some detail to fair use so we know what's going on, knowing full well that bright line rules, as we said before, does mean we'll get a few annoying cases wrong because that's the nature of its bright lineness. It's going to get a couple cases off because we're not thinking of all the factors and doing all the fact-specific work. But I hear that. Fair use, you can't advise a client that something is fair use. You can advise a client that you've got a good argument that it's fair use. And for a lot of clients, having a good argument isn't enough. They don't want the stress. They don't take the risk. And so I'd love to see sharper lines in fair use. And you're tying into the Warner Brothers example. You know, one of the things I pushed Jeremy on a little bit was, this is a wonderful worldview, but how do we communicate it to the world? So let's say that in general, a company like Warner is fine with fan fiction. How do the fans know that? Do we want them to sit there and be writing their fan fiction, not thinking about the legal issue? I don't like that. I'm a law professor. I want them to realize that they're doing derivative work. Do we want them to be writing and worrying they're going to be sued and just the nice truth is they won't? I don't like that either because I want to discourage the writing. But it's not like Warner is going to get up and call everybody or put a big public posting in part because
they could readily put a Creative Commons license on.
Yeah, but abuse is the problem, right? There's these are tough lines. Most fan fiction, fine. But wow, what if you do a fan fiction film using high-powered filming equipment with stars acting in it? All of a sudden, you've made a sequel, and articulating the line ahead of time is tough. But we all know that, you know, there's certain fan fiction films that Warner would be fine with, and certain that they wouldn't. If Paramount is a big fan of Harry Potter and they film a movie and they have Matt Damon playing the lead role, it's no longer fan fiction, even if they give it away. And so I think it's hard to pre-disclaim things because someone's going to abuse it. And so that just goes to your point, Denise. The bright lines are not there. And that probably does limit our ability to enjoy flexibility that I think everyone would be happy to give whether the law requires it or not.
Do you see any help for that down the line? I mean, the reform litigation that gets proposed to Congress tends to be more specific than simply fixing fair use. Do you see any hope for this on the horizon?
It's not where I put my firepower. So it's an issue I wish was fixed, but we're not up to that level of nicety yet. You know, copyright law, patent law, which we haven't done at all, you know, here today, but it's another thing care passionately about. We got huge problems that are slowing down our development of new technologies, curing diseases, making a lot of good companies pay a lot of money they shouldn't have to pay, messing up a whole bunch of things. If you make the list of what's wrong in the patent and copyright systems and then make the bigger list of what's wrong in the world, Congress is not and should not get to the fair use fan fiction issue. I can't wait to live in the society where that bubbles up. But we're not living in that society right now. If I could get the ear of Congress, this is not what I'm talking to them about. Patent reform, far more important to me right now. And even if you make me stay in copyright law, let's get the damages stuff fixed because we're getting too much of a mess there with crazy high damages coming back, undermining the public's confidence in the legal system. And that's no good. A big part of what copyright does is it teaches people about law, because it comes into their lives on a daily basis. And I don't want people to learn lessons like ignore it, or it's out of its mind, or it favors the corporations, none of which is true. But sadly, it's the lesson people are taking. And I'd love to see that sort of stuff fixed first. So fair use, I'm hoping good people like Jeremy Williams can do a lot of the heavy lifting while Congress doesn't have time, by standing up and doing reasonable things, by being sensitive to what the customer backlash looks like. We've got really good, thoughtful people on both sides. You know, Fred Von Lohman of the EFF is a wonderful, thoughtful guy who has good sense of how to draw lines. I think we let Fred and Jeremy and us do a lot of this heavy lifting and let Congress focus on other stuff right now.
Okay. Well, we have a bit of time left in the show, and I'd love to take what you just said as our jumping off point to wrap up. I'd love to hear your wish list for what things do need to be fixed and how we or Congress should go about fixing them. So if you could kind of run down, if you had the ability to wave a magic wand and solve the intellectual property law issues that are most urgent in the U.S. and potentially globally today, What would you address first and how?
Sure. I wish I had that magic wand. I guess for me, I'm passionate. And she could tell just talking with me today, I care about copyright issues a lot. I think patent issues are way more important. What I always tell my students at the beginning of the survey class is you're here because of copyright, but when you leave, you're going to be glad you were here because of patent. There's no issue out there that patent law doesn't touch. If you care about environment, you care about medicine, you care about the moving forward of new technologies like PCs and on and up, whatever you care about, the patent system is hugely influential in driving money toward moving it forward or putting roadblocks in the way of it moving forward. So patent law trumps all else in terms of what I want to fight about. Inside patent law, I think the system is enormously broken right now. I think the patent law does very little in terms of encouraging good innovation and does a lot in terms of encouraging people to go after money and take money from others, but not the good people, not the people who actually are making breakthrough technologies. And the patent system is doing middling at best in terms of moving money and recognition to the people who are moving the world forward and doing a lot toward moving it toward people who are completely undeserving. And we could fix that. That's a policy. That's an empirical comment. Fine. We can fix it. And there are problems in the way the system is run. Among them, number one, and an easy one to fix, we pretend that the patent office is able to evaluate patent applications and judge that something is, in fact, new and worthy of protection. And that's ridiculous. Of course they can't. When a new invention shows up at the patent office, it is some government employee with the resources he's given fighting against some major well-financed entity that wants to get their patent through. And with that, I'm saved by the bell. Sorry, kill that. All right, I turned off that phone and another one will ring. Sorry about that. I don't have any good way to kill that in the background. So you have a little joyful ringing, maybe a celebration of my comments. We're in a system that we expect that the patent office can do these things. They're outgunned in terms of the difference between what the patent examiner has in his hands and what the applicant has in his. We're also asking people at the patent office to judge inventions early in time. It's as if, I'm sorry, can you hang for 1 second? I'm just going to kill the background noise there because my answering machine is now picking up.
Sure, absolutely.
Sorry.
That's all right. We just did a show on patent law a few episodes ago, and I'm hearing a lot of echoes of what we discussed there.
There's probably some patentable subject matter in that answering machine, too.
I was hoping it'd be something really exotic and clever, like we'd catch on the podcast, you know, my mom calling or something.
Oh, my God. Just as an aside, I was talking at Qualcomm down in San Diego yesterday, and I saw their patent wall, which is 2 stories high and perhaps, I don't know, 50 yards across of all the patents that this company has racked up over the years. And I commented to the person who was helping me out of the building, and he said, oh, yeah, we've got a research and development building across the way, and there's another wall just like that over there.
But Qualcomm is a company we can cheer for in a lot of ways. When you look, I've looked closely at their patents for some work I've done, and they're doing real stuff. The cell phones that we all love, mm-hmm. A lot of why they work is Qualcomm, so good for them. Even saying that, though, I think the time to judge patentable invention isn't day zero, isn't at the patent office, where you have this dynamic I was beginning to paint about the examiner being outgunned. We also work in a world where information is thin. Right, the day Al Gore invented the internet, if I ask you to describe the internet and think through what it is, good luck with that. Whereas now, a couple years later, we have a much better sense of what that thing is and how to talk about it and what's new there and so on. And so the patent office isn't where I do the heavy lifting. And the legal fix I'd push is to say we need to stop deferring to the patent office. Right now, the patent system says if the patent office allowed the patent to issue, courts should assume, should defer, should put a lot of weight on their view that it's good. And that's just silly. The patent office is a group of wonderful people working really hard, but they're totally outgunned. If they're right, then the strength of their reasoning should convince us, but we shouldn't be deferring to them. And even if we just made that one change, if we stopped deferring to their decision and instead let us revisit it years later, either revisit it at the patent office or revisit it in court, we could then revisit it when we were so much richer in terms of our ability to think about it. We'd have adversaries. We'd have information. We'd focus on the couple patents that really matter because we know they withstood the test of time. We could really do it right. And so I say, I care tremendously about copyright too, no question. But if I could fix one thing, I'd go to the patent system. I'd take the presumption that patents are valid, this rule that defers to the patent office, and showing full respect to them. They're doing what they can. But even knowing that, we shouldn't be deferring. We should be listening to them, weighing their arguments on the merits, but then fighting about it when we know which patents matter, when we know what they mean, when we have an adversary, and we know the stakes.
Okay, so patent reform being first and foremost, are statutory damages in copyright the next thing in your sights, if you could fix our intellectual property law?
I'd probably do a couple more things in the patent system, truth be told, just because there's so many things that we could fix and tweak. And you know, something like a Qualcomm example is close to my heart. I want a company like Qualcomm to have good access to talent and money and research and so on. But you know, if we were to leave the patent line of things, so five things to fix in patent law, when that's all done, I'm sure if we go to copyright law, the damages stuff is something I'd like to see fixed. In part, like I say, because the public reaction to it. Just like I said about digital rights management, doesn't matter what I think. Doesn't matter if I think encryption has a couple charms here and there and could be something that would be a good way to set up society. Doesn't matter what I think. When the public is so sure that it's no good, we need to make some changes. And so too with damages. Doesn't matter whether we could tell stories about why statutory damages as is just fine. You look at the way the world reacts to it, and it's calling into question the credibility of law. And I don't want that. Law needs to be sensitive to its customer base, and the customers are the people who are listening to it and need to trust it. And statutory damages has become a thing that causes us not to trust copyright law. And knowing that, I'd love to see that fixed, be it through court or through Congress.
So the devil's advocate position on that is, of course, that the damages are what cause people not to trust copyright law, but the copyright proponents would say the damages are what cause copyright law to be enforceable because the technologies have made it so easy to manipulate digital material. Do you have any sympathy for that position at all?
I do, and statutory damages reform for me isn't take it away or make it piddly. I just think what you need to do is make sure the law clearly explains what we're doing. So in the cases and the things that get the public upset, we come up with these things that sound like crazy numbers. And so, you know, Charlie Nesson can falsely and strategically stand up and say, my poor little client, $7 songs and $1 million, even though that's a ridiculous caricature of the whole event. We need to fix that. Statutory damages law clearly needs to be sharpened so people understand, how should you think about those numbers? When we send a jury back with a range, what do we expect the jury to do with that? And you know, where I fault current statutory damages process is that we don't do a great job of telling a jury, and hence telling the public, here's what you should be doing. When you look at this, here are the kind of things you should weigh in as you think of the damages number. Here are things that are off limits. Just because you're mad at the guy, they shouldn't be raising it and so on. The detail of how we want them to think it through is not explicit in the current process. That leads to mistakes in the jury rooms because they don't know what to do. And it leads to the public looking at this and saying, what? Why is that? And you know, even worse, falling for the shenanigans and the misleading work of someone like Charlie Nesson, who takes this situation and then intentionally distorts it, in my view, to try to get people up in arms and pretend like the rest of us are crazy, when in fact the truth is very far from it.
Did you guys take a look at the document that the RIAA put out as guidelines for schools and how they should teach students about copyright law and damages as part of it?
Yeah, I took a look at that, and I was thinking about that a little while ago when Doug, you were saying that, you know, big content industry, they're not a bunch of ogres. I thought you were just talking about the MPAA. AA, right? Not the RIA. I'm joking. But yeah, I took a look at that, and it reads, you know, very much, you know, for once I'll have to agree with a characterization that Mike Masnick and many others, you know, have made, that it really does look a lot like propaganda, coining this term, or at least picking up on what was, you know, somewhat of an obscure term before this, song lifting, which, you know, implicates notions of theft, which kind of go against, which, you know, everybody calls it content stealing and and you know, content theft and all that stuff. But really, that's not really how copyright law works. It's more in the nature of trespass than it is theft or conversion. But so it was interesting to see that real spin. But you know, gosh, don't we say this in every episode? You know, why is it surprising to us that the RIAA would take a position that is one that's easy for us to sit here and ridicule? So right. It's good stuff.
Interesting in that I encourage, you know, I know some of the folks at RIAA and MPAA and the studios and all the rest, just sitting here in Los Angeles at UCLA, you have access to all those folks. I've encouraged everyone who listened to me to go read Tech Dirt. Because while I think Mike goes too far in the caricature he paints of the other side and sometimes waves off arguments that I think deserve some more thought and respect, Mike does a great job of pointing out how stupid the content industry sounds. If you think about it, there is a very sympathetic story to tell. You think, for example, you're the Associated Press. You've got a story to tell. It takes a lot of money to gather the news. It's a wonderful, valuable thing that they do. We need some way to make sure we can pay for all of that. It's tough right now in the world of copying and blogs and Twitter and this or that. They have a sympathetic story. And as Mike always effectively lampoons, most of them have no idea to tell the sympathetic story. You could stand up there as the movie industry, the TV producers, everybody, and say, look, I get it. You want access to stuff at low cost. You want to do remixes and fan fiction. You want to roll out new technologies that we might be slow on. I want to support you. And I ask that you also support me, because here's my side of that. I need some money to pay back for all of this, because I want to be able to spend my life making this content. There's a wonderful story to tell. And stereotypically, the content industry, if you look at how have they failed, they failed in telling the story. And it's ironic because these are the guys you'd think could tell the story. Right? The guy who writes West Wing, why can't he write a good press release? Once for his team explaining in a balanced way. It's right. Amazing this is that they miss. This is one thing, you know, I do a bunch of consulting and all that as well. Again, I want to be in the real world. And probably the most valuable thing I do for my clients is try to do that. So when Viacom sued YouTube, we ran two editorials in the newspaper the day we filed suit. One in the Los Angeles Times and one of the DC papers, where we said what we meant. I wrote one of them, signed under my byline, and it begins, I love YouTube. I hate suing them today. This is not what I wanted to do with my life. Love it. I want to see YouTube survive. It is valuable and it does useful stuff. I'm here because I have to be. I'm here because they're not being responsible and a lot of other issues they're brushing off. But we love them. Right? And that's the right message. The press release couldn't be, YouTube is evil. It's not clearly evil. Couldn't be YouTube should be killed. It shouldn't be. We need to just call it clean. And it amazes me that RIAA, MPAA, all of these entities whose job it is to speak to the public and to the government haven't quite figured out how to tell what is an easy story, a sympathetic story about we love all this stuff and we need a little love too.
And it's easy to be the one, you know, attacking the incumbent, you know, to in the sense that the big content industry is the incumbent, you know, in its entrenched position as being the one historically responsible for generating and creating this content. And, you know, when you were talking about Mike Masnick and how you encouraged people to read him and to see how well he can articulate some of the issues here, it kind of reminds me of this notion of the court jester. You know, the king would permit the jester to be there and to point out the ridiculousness in a lot of positions, but it's still the official position of the king that's there. In a lot of the same way, it's the, you know, with commentators, Mike Masnick coming to the top of mind on this stuff, you know, point out, you know, these things and, you know, bring these things to light. And it does seem to be a void that exists, Doug, like you're talking about there, is this counterpoint from the position of the incumbent that paints a sympathetic story. And if that were there, if that void were filled, it would be a much more, you know, well-intentioned, much more robust and sensible and rational discourse over a lot of the aspects of this conundrum of how to deal with content in the modern, you know, with the modern tools that we have.
And a big part of the reason I started...
Thank goodness for you taking that position, Doug, because it's so necessary, and I imagine it can be an uphill battle. I can just picture in my mind you presenting proposed copy for a brief or an article and having someone come along with their red pen and say, can't we call this piracy or stealing? So continue to fight the good fight on that front.
And one of the reasons I started the IP Colloquium podcast is the same thing. If you look at what's out in blogs and podcast land, it is very much the Mike Masnick view of the world, where the other side is a little bit caricatured, and then some thoughtful work is done off the caricature. But my view, and I'm the same here as I am there, as I am in my work, as I am in my consulting, as I am in the courts, as I am in Congress, wherever I am, I try to aim for kind of that middle. I see sympathies in both sides. I don't want copyright to kill the invention of cool new technologies. I also don't want to see the value created by the content industry completely ignored either. And so IP Colloquium was my way of getting into the public conversation. And I pull in people like Mike. Fred Van Lohman at the FF was the first guest on my show, because Fred is a wonderful spokesman for a different set of views than mine. And he and I pushing each other back and forth in what was a terrible audio, and we were still getting started and figuring out how to do a radio show. But that conversation...
It's one of my favorite shows that you've done. It was fantastic.
I cringe when I listen to the first four, because we hadn't yet figured out how to clean up the audios and hit pause and simple things. We were very raw sound. But I had Charlie Nesson on, even though, as you could tell from my comments, I think what he's done in the Tenenbaum peer-to-peer case is dishonorable, let alone wrong, dishonorable. But I had him on the show. We talked only merits and serious substance, because I want the world to hear both sides intelligently articulated and realize that Nesson isn't so clearly right as he pretends to be, but there is a nugget of truth there. Statutory damages are broken. There's the nugget. And the rest of the stuff against someone like me, he has to start conceding and seeing some other moves. IP Colloquium is designed to be my way to get out to the world what I've been saying more quietly to the LA crowd by telling them, Mike Masnick's on to something. Read Tech Dirt. Understand how you're heard. Don't understand what you're saying. And IP Colloquium is part of that game for me to do that another way with my voice in the mix.
Doug, I think that's great that you're doing that. I really do. I think that what the problem has been that people, each side is pretending like there is no other point of view. And I think if both sides can come together and talk about that other part that they acknowledge has some merit, or at least, if it's not the law, the social aspect that's compelling. We all love YouTube or whatever, we love these things. We hate DRM. We want certain things because we want them. And maybe the law doesn't enable them, but at least we have to recognize the reality of what is the social momentum, what are the legal constraints. And if we can talk about reality, well, then maybe we can change something. But if we're just going to each take the position that we're inherently right and the other side is completely bogus and deserves to be ridiculed, then there's no conversation and there's nothing meaningful going on.
Right. That's exactly where I am.
Doug, I hope you have in your arsenal as well on that front the EFF's teachingcopyright.org guide. Have you checked that out?
I glanced at it. I didn't have time to go through it with as much care as I would like. I did glance at it to see. It's certainly beautifully executed. They have the sense of how to do the graphic and the flow.
Right.
They really execute very nicely. I didn't get to audit it for how much the law is as balanced as they say. Although I will say I have enormous respect, even though EFF and I disagree in many cases. So, Fred Van Lohman, Sherry Steele, these are wonderful, thoughtful people doing really important work. We needed someone to stand up and fight the fights they fight. And, Fred in particular blows me away. Every time I interact with him, that he's willing to concede weaknesses, that he really has a thoughtful bottom line at the bottom. EFF folks are, I have only wonderful things to say about them. It's wonderful to have an adversary that you actually really can think that well of.
So I forgot to circle back, and I will as we round out the show here, to this Vader project thing that I mentioned on the subject of fan fiction and derivative works. We never put the period on that sentence to see if, and I'll just back up here for the listeners and say that there was an exhibit at the Andy Warhol Museum in Pittsburgh called The Vader Project, and it was reimaginings of the iconic Darth Vader helmet, sort of tweaked and mashed up. And Mike Madison over at the University of Pittsburgh was wondering what sort of rights clearances had on, whether any of it was cleared with Lucas and Lucasfilm. But even if it wasn't, his take was that the artists and the museum were on solid legal ground. And I just wondered if you felt the same way, Doug, or had another possible take on that.
George Lucas is widely revered as the guy who was one of the first people with massively valuable copyright rights who adopted the let it go view. And so Lucas has been remarkably open-minded through his whole run about letting people use his stuff in fun ways. And, you know, the content industry insiders say that's why you could go, you know, 12 years between Star Wars movies and still have enormous demand. George Lucas understood that by letting go, by letting his fans become tied to these characters and these stories and do fan fiction, all the rest, that's good for everybody, good for them, and good for him when he wants to roll out the next commercial polished product. And so he's a fun example where, you know, even if the law was skittish, he might be more open to things than most people because his view is about just getting his stuff out there into the world. On the details of this display, interesting. I could see an interesting fair use defense arguing that there's not huge commercial impact. There is transformative use and so on. I don't have a fine-grained view. Again, not my case. And so I don't know the details of exactly what the ramifications are and so on. But there certainly is a story to be told about fair use. I think what's interesting in that example is we wouldn't need to tell it. My guess is if they write a letter to George Lucas's people, that they wrote back saying, cool, send us some pictures, is my guess of what would happen.
All right. Well, I'm going to give Ernie and Evan the opportunity to fire any last minute, last thought kind of questions out for us to discuss. Do you guys have anything that you want to add, or shall we wrap this up?
The only thing that I would add is just a point that we could, you know, go into, you know, some substantive discussion on. We were talking earlier about the DMCA, and, you know, the liability of the intermediary, what to do, what these complex questions are, how far down or how far up should you have to reach to pick the low-lying fruit and all that stuff. And one thing that, you know, is often or that we often neglect to talk about is this notion of trademark liability as well. I mean, of course, this past summer we've seen that decision in the Louis Vuitton case. You know, what's the responsibility of the intermediary to to stop the trademark infringement? And I just think it's interesting. I think it was either yesterday or the day before yesterday, there was a lawsuit filed against Linden Labs. I think it's another sex toys lawsuit, I believe. I just read the complaint very, very, very briefly, dealing with some copyright questions, but also throwing some trademark stuff in there. So these questions of secondary liability aren't going to go away. So my observation, just kind of throw it out there for you know, taking points at, is just it's a much more complex question than just the copyright issue. And, you know, we talk about defamation from time to time, but then there's this trademark stuff, the real instruments of commerce causing some real big problems with intermediary liability, something I find perennially interesting.
Yeah, it just makes me step back and think about the fact that I'm constantly of the mind that our copyright and intellectual property framework in general struggles with the way the real world actually works. And courts are always in that unfortunate position of trying to look at the real world and apply our legal framework and operate right at that collision point. And I guess the question flowing from that to Doug is, how do you think things are going to look in, say, 20, 25 years? Do you think that the law will actually evolve so that we don't have so much tension between what people expect and how they act and what the law tries to impose? Or will we still be, you know, right in the middle of all this?
It's hard to know. You know, law always is trying to play catch up. So to the extent that's what we're feeling now, I think that's common. Every time you even knew the record player, the motion picture shows up, when sound recordings became a big deal, law's always playing catch up. So that doesn't surprise me. What I think is new now and hopefully won't be here in 20 years is not only are we playing catch up, but we're also alienating the public. I think that's what's special about this moment in time for copyright law as compared to previous moments in time. The law has always been it's a mismatch, always had some tough cases, always been trying to catch up to new technologies. But I don't know that we've had the level of public antipathy toward the law or toward the people who use the law that we do now. And hopefully that will settle down in part through better messaging and better explanation of the sympathetic points on both sides, in part because we'll resolve some of these tough issues.
Good answer. Ernie, do you have any last thoughts? Ernie, are you still with us? Are you on mute?
Yeah, I'm here. I'm sorry about that.
I
pulled the Colette. I guess my question is I really enjoyed listening to you, Doug, and you do a great job of articulating a point of view that I don't hear often. Yeah. So I will for sure be tuning into IP Colloquium and checking out all of your content there. Are there any other sites besides yours that you could recommend to people that want to educate themselves on that that viewpoint?
I'm sure. There's a blog called Copyrights and Campaigns, which is trying to come in and be like the anti-tech dirt. And so on Copyrights and Campaigns, they're writing and trying to add the other side to the stories that run on a place like tech dirt. So they've covered many of the things we've talked about. And just laying out some of the details of the law, some of the sympathetic story on the other side. And I think trying to hit the middle ground, the sweet spot where I also aim, but doing through a different medium and in a different style. It's kind of a fun, quirky style. So I find that another site that does at least articulate different views than what you're reading on the main sites. And then they say we're trying to do it just through the podcast format also.
Great. Thanks. I appreciate that.
Wonderful. Thanks to everyone who tuned in live and to all of you who will listen to the podcast after the fact. I think this has been a really fun show. Doug, I can't thank you enough. Folks, go over to ipcolloquium.com and download each and every one of Doug's shows because they're all
twice,
fantastic.
Right?
Yeah, twice. And as an added bonus, if you're a lawyer, they are aligned with a firm. I forget who that is, Doug. You want to give them a plug?
We actually self-supply now, but we're sponsored by Loeb & Loeb, the law firm, and LECG, the economic consultancy, as our standing sponsors through the whole run. And then we've built the infrastructure. We give free CLE credit in New York, California, Illinois, Texas, Washington, New Hampshire, a whole bunch of places. Through a bunch of sponsors, we have rotating sponsors who pick up the tab for the CLE. And then, like I say, Loeb & Loeb and LECG have been with us from day one, helping pay for the infrastructure to get all that paperwork out so we can issue. If we need to a couple thousand CLE certificates a day, we can do that because they back us
right.
And make sure that happens.
And I've been through that process. For the non-lawyers listening, we lawyers have to go to continuing legal education to keep our bar tickets current and be licensed to continue practicing. So Doug's show is one great way to get participatory credit in a very interesting way. And the process is very streamlined. You, I like how you orchestrate it, Doug. You listened for a little treasure word hidden within the podcast, and then that demonstrates that you've actually listened, and you can go in and put those in and get your credit after the fact. I will only suggest that the opportunities for gaming that certainly exist and hope that you aren't the victim of that kind of situation like the content owners are the victim of end running their various security measures.
Right.
But anyway.
We have some protections in there. The fun part of the treasure words is picking them because you can add a little subtle commentary on the show by choosing the treasure word in the right way. So that's the fun part of and I've had people have been wonderful. We track downloads, timing. We have a good sense of who's actually playing the show and marry that up to the CLE requests. And it's been one-to-one. It's been really, really honorable and good. I think people listen and like the show. So that's good.
Yes, wonderful. And that makes your little words memorable too. So I don't have to run and get a pen and write them down. I tend to be able to pull them out of memory when it comes time to actually log in and get the credit. Evan, thank you so much for being here and representing the Chicago School. As usual, internetcases.com.
Hey, thanks for having me. Great time as usual.
Wonderful to have you back. And Ernie, thanks so much.
It's great to be here representing the Creole Cooking School.
Creole Cooking School, yes. Ernie, theattorney.net. Folks can find Ernie on Twitter at Ernie Attorney. Evan is at Internet Cases. Doug, you're on Twitter twice, right? You are IP Colloquium and Doug underscore Lichtman.
Right. I mainly try to use the podcast and in email, though, and LinkedIn and Facebook. I'm not a huge Twitter guy yet. Still learning my way around there.
All right. Well, we'll get you a bunch of followers, hopefully, and you can start yakking away and see how that works for you.
Sounds great. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. And just a programming note for next week, we have Gary Reback on the show, along with returning guest Rick Clow, who is the project manager for Blogger at Google. And Ernie will be guest hosting for me while I am off speaking at a thing in Northern California. And Evan will be here too. So I hope you folks will enjoy that show. It should be a good one. Tune in at 11 Pacific. And we'll see you then. Thanks, everyone.